But then I sort of said to the team or the organization, it's more about becoming a little bit better every week, every campaign, every season, every year. If we do that over time, we will be really, really good. And that also takes away the kind of anxiety about change management, because it's not about becoming like a wizard or becoming the best in the world. It's just about becoming a little bit better.
Hi there, logistics fans, and welcome to Out of the Box, your go-to podcast about everything cool that's going on in the world of logistics. With a lot of smart people, we not only talk about supply chain strategies, but also the future of e-commerce, robotics, last mile, and more. So if you're ready, then sit back, grab a snack, and let's unbox the hottest trends in logistics with Pia, Margarita, and me, Lynn.
So welcome back to Out of the Box. I'm Pia, and here with me, I have my lovely co-host Lynn today.
Hey.
Today, we are going to talk about the fascinating world of retail. And right away, I have a question for you, Lynn. When you think about rolling out a logistics project in a retail company, what would you say are the most important points or steps?
So I think this could be actually quite a long list and very extensive. But of course, next to the main investments, such like a high bay warehouse, you also have to consider, I would say, soft effects such as, do my employees actually accept the new solution? How can I train them? And these kind of considerations. What about you, Pia? Do you have anything to add?
I think that's a really good start. But fortunately, we have somebody here who is definitely a better judge for that. Our guest today is Paul Weib. He has over 25 years of experience in the retail industry and held positions both as CEO and board member at several retail companies such as Europris, I hope the pronunciation is correct, or XXL All Sports United. And logistics played a major part in his jobs as CEO and makes him an expert in supply chain optimization. So a perfect conversation partner for today. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. And wow, that's quite an introduction, but I'll try to live up to it.
I'm sure.
Yes. Also, basically, my background is I actually used to be a McKinsey consultant before I went into retail. But I thought that after 5 years with McKinsey in Australia, Switzerland and in the Nordics, I thought I needed a real job. And then so then that was how I got into retail. And the first 7 years of my career, I worked with grocery retail, which was, in retrospect, very, very fortunate, because both then, I also think today, grocery retail has typically been quite in the forefront of logistic solutions on the replenishment side, on the sort of planogram, space management, and all that stuff. So I really learned the trick of the trade in grocery retail for 7 years. And then I started working 2 years with the duty-free business in Norway. So it was a German company called Heinemann that won the tender for the airports in the Nordics, in Norway. And that was also very professional, very, very, they have a high fully automated warehouse back in 2004, which was quite impressive. So the logistics was working fantastic. I did that for 3 years, and then I got my real exam, which was this Nille company that I worked with, which is in the discount variety retail sector. So it's like non-food, mainly a concept for ladies, like it's home and interior, birthday products for kids, seasonal products. And that was the total opposite. That was very, very simple systems, or no systems at all, very manual. And nothing that I have sort of learned so far was implemented in this sector. So I basically, I sort of had to learn it the hard way. I worked 7 years at Nille and then 7 years at Europris, which is like a bigger format in the same sector. So I think it's really a journey from almost no systems to what I would say today is sort of at the level of the grocery sector in terms of replenishment and structure, the planograms, the spacing, and the automation, everything. It's sort of really, really, really professional. But it back in 2006 when I started, it was definitely not very sort of modern and sort of automated replenishment and logistical systems. And then I had a couple of years at XXL, which uses AutoStore, which is a fully automatic system. So that was sort of the logistics part was very sort of good. But we had more work to do in the replenishment part of the system. So I really had to learn from scratch, and I still feel like I'm learning. That is the fascinating thing about retail, that even 25 years after I started, it's still a sector that really, really develops. Now we have machine learning or advanced machine learning and AI that is again transforming the industry.
That's a really cool journey. And I saw on LinkedIn that you described yourself as a retail nerd. And I really love that expression. Is there a point in your career where you said, okay, my passion for retail, for logistics started?
I think it started sort of in the beginning. I came into the kind of, I did the work, not necessarily directly with retail. So I think I actually, the point where I really learned it was, as I said, the hard way. That was back in 2007. I had just started as a CEO of this Nille company. It was a private equity-owned company. We were transforming a family-owned company into a modern professional company. And we had a fantastic year on terms of sales. I think sales grew by 30%. In 2007, and that's not normal in the market. So our logistical setup was not set up for growing 30%. So the warehouse was too small. It was too manual. The replenishment system was not there. Everything was not working. So it just basically crashed. We fixed it, but we fixed it in a manual way. And it was a very, very humbling and expensive learning experience. But then I really understood that up until then, I've been working in the grocery sector and with Heinemann in the duty-free business, and logistics was something I didn't had to think about because it was working very professionally. But then I understood that if you are supposed to be a successful retailer, you really have to have control of logistics. And those who don't, they might have a good sales development, but the bottom line is not really as good as you want to. So that was how I got into logistics. And from then, I sort of been learning the tricks of the trade and learning every year and getting a little bit smarter every year. And I think basically in retail, there's a lot of people who is very much, you know, they've been in the business for a long time. And the benefit of that is that you really get into the nuts and bolts of the business. And I love details. I've been learning now for 25 years.
That's actually a super cool summary. Or to be actually honest, for me, it's a bit surprising that you have like this specific view on it, because I imagine as a CEO, you not only have the logistics side on your plate, but really financials, HR topics and so on. So I wonder what your perspective was, which kind of strategy you could actually see in each segment, because you already talked about it. So with Nille.
Yeah, yeah.
We get a Norwegian crash course here.
Very good.
You have very different items than with XXL Sports, for example. So I wonder, how was it for you as a CEO to actually manage this, and how did you actually decide on these kind of strategies? Because it's something completely different to have like food with like best before dates, which you need to manage, versus, I don't know, bulky sport items like skis, which you need to ship. So,
I think that the point was that there's a reason why grocery sector always is a little bit advanced compared to many other sectors. It is because, of course, it's been around forever. It was one of the first sectors to sort of professionalize and create large chains that could automate. The supplier industry is much more developed, and the industry has been working in for many years, both in Norway and in Europe, for general standards, and everything was sort of more standardized. So basically, in the grocery sector, the good thing about starting early in the grocery sector was that I felt like there everything was in place. When you started in the discount variety sector, which is like non-food items, typically a lot of them from China or the Far East, you know, the Chinese suppliers, they don't understand this just in time, the kind of the product PIM data, the need for accurate data. There are, of course, things that can happen on the way from the Far East to Europe. So the kind of precision in the supply chain is less. And historically, it's been a lot of focus on just having the lowest priced products in the market, which means that it's more about manual simplicity than systems and professionalism. So I think that for me, it was very good to start in the duty-free and the grocery sector because I learned what sort of modern and professional was. And then luckily for me, it started off with a crash where I learned at Nille that you can't grow 30% if you're not having a much bigger turnover of your central warehouse. Then you really have to have a very fast turnover of the central warehouse. Otherwise, it just clogs up. So I learned the hard way. And then I also saw the need to actually professionalize all parts from buying and category, marketing planning, to logistics replenishment systems. I mean, these retailers didn't have a really replenishment systems. They had Excel-based min-max systems. So it was a very, very sort of simple supply chain. If you do that, that's a big change journey. It's really, you cannot do that in 1 year. You have to take it step by step. Mm-hmm. So it was, great kind of learning experience when I had the opportunity to do that in two companies over 14, 15 years. I felt like it's almost like setting up a totally new company from scratch. Very, very, very interesting. So basically, when I came into the discount variety retail sector, I had the focus on category and marketing because that was what I was sort of taught up to that. That was the critical part. That was the one that wasn't structured and working. All the other parts was working. So that's why I did a lot of innovation in that area. And we were successful in terms of increasing sales, as I said. But I understood that if you're not professional in the supply chain and logistics, then all the profit goes away in manual handling and sort of delays and extra costs. So in addition to sort of the modern replenishment systems and the planograms and the space management and all that stuff, I built two new central warehouses, or three if you count one with XXL2. So in addition, I built central warehouses basically in addition, because you have to modernize and sort of professionalize all parts of the business.
I guess there your path as a consultant comes out a bit to structure and manage
it does, but at the same time I have to say that this is not like retail is not like a sort of individual game, it's a team sport. So really in all these companies I wasn't the guy doing the work, actually I was of course heading it, but I very early in that first job to learn that you had to have the right people with the right mindset that could really take a family-owned business to becoming a professional, but also being hands-on, not just theoretically knowing what to do, but also in practice, knowing what it means to take a company from no systems to all systems and a modern, establishing a modern new central warehouse. So I think the reason why it went well was not necessarily just because of me, it was actually more because of the team that I was able to assemble around me.
I hope they listen to this episode.
hopefully so.
Yeah. And before this, you also touched kind of the topic of Chinese suppliers. So for me, I must admit, I do order from AliExpress and Temu on, but it's super but it's super hard to actually sometimes track it, and you don't really know where the order is. And you also said it's always about having a resilient logistics process. So how do you actually ensure this? Also, if you hear the news from the Red Sea, for example, with the attacks and so on, is there anything where you also touch base during your career?
Yeah, I think so. The other thing I did in addition to establishing three central warehouses was that I established two sourcing organizations in the Far East. So basically, once you have a scale, you need to establish your own organization closer to the suppliers so that you can follow it up locally. And you have to have systems so that this sort of sourcing organization works very closely with the category and the supply team in the Nordics or in Europe. So I think that was also another thing that I learned, that it's not like you can calling from Germany or from Norway and following up orders. Let's say under COVID, of course, it's impossible to follow up Chinese suppliers by phone or mail. You have to have people on the ground that can actually be much closer to the suppliers and find solutions. So I think it's the same there as it is with the replenishment team and the logistics team, that you need to have really good people, but you also have to have a backbone of structure and systems so that it's sort of independent of the people, that things just work. And then you have to have a culture where everybody is sort of focusing on becoming a little bit better every day and every week and every campaign, so that over time you actually get very you get very good at it. So for example, during COVID, my the company Europris that I was CEO of, which I'm still at the board of, my board of director there, they were like not just beating the market during COVID, they also significantly beat the discount variety retail sector in their local market, just because they were very, very close to the suppliers. They had a team in the Far East that was very close to them, and they were able to handle all the turbulences and ups and downs a little bit better than most other retailers. And that was a critical success factor. So, and even with the Red Sea kind of turbulence now, I'm pretty sure that they are also going to handle it very well now. So I think it's all about the team, structure, and the systems to support it.
Okay, thank you.
What you've told us, I understand that logistics optimization or supply chain optimization is often about continuously learning, continuously improving. And from my experience, oftentimes those improvements or new technologies come with a big change for the people who have to work with them or who worked in any other ways before. How important is change management here, and how can you also foster a culture of continuous improvement within your logistics team?
That's a very good question. And before I answer, just to sort of say, I actually think this is one of those areas where people who work in the grocery sector, they are a little bit spoiled, because in the grocery sector, most of your suppliers are very close to you, which means that if there's a trouble, if you're missing on a replenishment forecast, I mean, maybe the supplier is a couple of days away, not maybe even less, which means that you can always sort of fix things if you have a trouble, maybe it's a week or two. But if you have a Far East Chinese supplier and you're missing on the forecast, I mean, then this season is gone. I mean, unless you fly the products home, which means that replenishment systems and good replenishment routines and systems and procedures actually has to be better in the non-food sector than in the food sectors. But even more sort of challenge for the people who work in those sectors. And I think I had a saying at Europris that I think people, I don't think they got sick of it, but at least they heard it many times. I said that we should always be a little bit better in everything we do, because a lot of people think that if you change management sounds so serious, sounds so difficult. You know, if very often you have this ambition that you want to be the best discount variety retailer in Europe, and you think, wow, that's really, really hard. But then I sort of said to the team, or the organization, it's more about becoming a little bit better every week, every campaign, every season, every year. If we do that, over time, we will be really, really good. And that also takes away the kind of anxiety about change management, because it's not about becoming like a wizard or becoming the best in the world. It's just about becoming a little bit better. And my experience is that everyone can agree that they can be better. So if you just agree to that and you try to be a little bit better, then over time, as long as you're staying with the company and over longer time, then you get really good.
I do have a question regarding this, because when you say, or if you can compare it between, okay, I start something like setting up these systems from scratch versus you do this continuous improvement, what do you think is actually more difficult? Because I think it's, of course, it's very different, but on the one side, you really have this kind of blank paper and you need to like start, which can also be very challenging. But then on the other hand, to really get these last 5% can be also super hard actually. Yeah. And like, to get these results.
I think the easy part is doing the systems, actually, to be honest. Even if, you know, I introduced new modern systems, replenishment systems, and as I said, automated warehouses, semi-automated warehouses. But actually getting those to work and getting those to work better and continuously better and better and better and better, that is actually the hardest thing. And I think it's all about installing a culture where people take pride in becoming a little bit better, and you celebrate, you know, the small victories. And as I said, the best examples I have is probably Europris, where I've worked for 7 years and I'm still at the board. And it's sort of, when I started in 2014, they didn't have any really inventory data on a product level in the stores. So they basically they had like a total, but not really on a product level that was working. And today they have, I would call a grocery standard replenishment systems with really good product information management. They have inventory, of course, at all products in all parts of the supply chain. They can follow it. And they're really at the fine tuning. They are at the last 2, 3, 4, 5% fine tuning now. And they have space management of even of seasonal non-food items from the Far East, which is I don't think even some of the people in the grocery sector have. So from absolutely almost nothing, just simple kind of Excel min-max systems, to being at the forefront of professional replenishment and sort of modern supply chain and logistics in 10 years. I think it's the easy part was the systems, but the difficult part was to get sort of 3,000 people in the organization to focus on that becoming a little bit better and thinking it's fun to be a little bit better.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like it sounds easy, but I know there's also like a lot to do actually, but to have like this kind of improvement of 50% with like a structure and system in place, of course, it's easy. But then to really make this top-notch difference is the super, super hard work.
Yeah. So yeah. And very often you keep in mind that if you look in the grocery sector or in you know, a lot of people, maybe they have like in the grocery sector, you have EBIT DA margins of 3, 4, 5% in the non-food, maybe 10, 12, but still, you know, 3, 4, 5% improvements. It's huge. It's very, very important. So it is the difference between okay and very good. Some of these small changes are actually quite massive.
And then another question also regarding improvements and also margins, which you talked about. Which kind of role do you think logistics or like sustainability in logistics and retail actually play? Because I also think about, you know, packaging and having like the choice between like rather cheap packaging and maybe more expensive but sustainable solutions. Is there anything you could also see as a change during your career that it got more importance? Or
yeah, obviously sustainability is one of those things that has, you know, when I started, nobody thought about it. I mean, there was not on the agenda really. And today, I think the best retailers are actually now ahead of their customers. At least what I see, that you know, they are more ambitious than their customers because they know that the customers are getting more and more ambitious every year because there's a new generation of people sort of growing up that demands even more of the retailers, but also government regulations. I live in Norway, obviously, but I'm a big fan of EU. and if you see on the environmental regulations and standards that are coming from EU now, it's like they are basically taking the financial standards that you have sort of worked forever in the financial industry, and they're applying the same logic to the sustainability reporting. And that's like, I don't think all people understand how ambitious it is and how much is going to change the way you run the companies. So, and then again, then it's so important to have structure and control and know what you're doing. Before you could sort of, you could be improvise, but now you have to have systems and structures and routines. So I think that's one area that is definitely changing. Then I also think that in some of the retailers that I worked with, we work a lot with giving customers a sustainable choice. So that if you go through a Europris store, you should always find that a sustainable alternative in each subcategory. So, you know, so we give the consumers the opportunity to choose sustainable products all the way through the store. That's another area that I think is coming more and more. The third area, which I think is one of those, I would say that this is one of those things that nobody talks about, but it's quite critical, is within e-commerce, you have the return rates. From a sustainability point of view, I think that this is something that nobody talks about. I think they're like they're covering their eyes and thinking hopefully it'll go away. But in some sectors, you have 20, 30, 40% return rates. If you know, if I sell you 100 products and you return 40 of them, I mean, this can never be sustainable. I mean, so I mean, there's a gap here between what the consumers want and what's happening at the moment that the retailers need to bridge. And I think it has to be done with a combination of technology, but also pricing. I think that you cannot have free returns forever. At some point, you have to pay if you are if you have such a huge footprint on society by returning 40% of what you buy, that has to cost.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you talk about it, because I also wonder why it's happening like this. And I guess it's a lot about like transparency or the missing transparency, because as an end customer, you think, okay, I don't want to keep it. I send it back. It's for free. It's no pain, not even a financial one. But then you also see that some companies change. So for example, I use eBay to like sell used stuff and so on. And they also have like one platform where they have like these kind of used or category B kind of products. So you see a bit of change, but of course there are sometimes these kind of scandals that like new shoes and so on are burned because it's just cheaper. So as you said, it's good that you also have like some regulations which will might stop it or make it not worth it anymore to like just destroy the stuff.
I think it will be managed by, I think we have to work on it because it's such a big question. I think we have to work on it in multiple ways. One thing is just to make it like that it has a price. If you return 40%, it has to have a price. That's one part of it. The other part is, of course, that, as you say, that you can start selling used products or things that are returned, that you can find a system for selling it. We did that at XXL, and that was actually quite a huge success on a small scale, but still very promising. And then I think again that, but this is the beauty of technology, that of course now technology is giving us a lot of data, so you can optimize the assortment. I mean, so you can give the suppliers feedback on which products are sort of have a too high return rate. Maybe the product information is wrong. Maybe the quality isn't good enough. You can also start punishing or incentivizing the suppliers in terms so that they also, you know, do something about their product development. So I think that you can optimize both the products, but also on the customer side, because we cannot sit here in 10 years and have on average 20-25% return rate. That's that you know, we will never reach our environmental targets if we are returning 25% of what we buy. That's impossible.
I totally agree that the return rate is a big problem for sustainability. And I think it's an interesting approach to, I don't know, to find technologies who can help with that. But I'm not sure if you can really price the return, or at least I think somebody has to start it, because right now I see more like it gets even easier to return your stuff. For example, the return period gets longer and longer. And I think as long as companies like Amazon, Zalando and stuff have those return policies that are really easy for the customers to give back what they ordered, I think nobody will do it.
Yeah, I think, and that's, I'm the old guy, so I'm supposed to be the cynical and the delusional guy here, but
I'm sorry.
I actually think that you're right, actually. But I think there's things happening. There was a Swedish e-commerce retailer, I think it was Boozt, who actually started, because what they saw was that there are some customers, I mean, most of us don't return 40% of what we buy. You know, there are some people who return almost as much as more than they buy, because they buy three pairs of shoes and then they return two of them. So they actually found out that a very small percentage of their customers was making up a huge part of their returns. So they're actually starting installing prices and penalizing those customers. So that's one part. You don't have to go out to all, because you don't want 0% return rate. That's not optimal. Then you have reduced sales too much. So you want to balance it. So I actually think you can do it and some will do it. I also think you mentioned, Lynn, that you were buying from Shein and Temu and the kind of Chinese Alibabas of this world. I think that's another sort of thing where I think that they should also pay for the freight. I mean, there's an international freight agreement, which means that they have subsidized freight from China or from the Far East. And I think that can also not last. They must pay for the kind of footprint of sending individual orders from China to individual consumers. That's not an efficient way of doing it. And at some point, that is going to happen. So I think those things are going to happen. But at the same time, I think you can also use technology, machine learning, AI, to optimize assortment and do a lot of stuff also in reducing. You know, we saw that in certain products, because the product information was not good enough. People didn't understand what is the right size for me, so they made mistakes and had to return products for good reasons. So of course, then you can optimize sort of the size guiding and maybe our models and tell them how big large the models are. So there's a lot of things you can do in cooperation with the suppliers to reduce the kind of natural return rate down to a more sustainable level. So I'm an optimist still.
Okay, that's good. Nice. And sorry for the negative.
No offense.
Okay, then maybe we come to a more positive question. If you look back at your career and you have recommendations for like young logistics enthusiasts who are starting a career nowadays in logistics, would you recommend your career again, or what would you recommend?
Well, I recommend people do what's best for them. So don't follow my footsteps. Looking back, I think I would have done very much a lot of the same. I thought, as I said, I was joking about McKinsey, but I think it was like an advanced continuation of school, where you sort of as a 25, 30-year-old could work with many different companies and learn a lot. So I thought it was maybe the best job to have for me after school, because I could continue learning. When I was leaving McKinsey, I actually had two opportunities. I could either go into retail, which I ended up doing, but I was also considering a tech startup. And I ended up with the grocery retail job, because I thought, this I understand. This was the dot-com boom, so I couldn't fully understand what was making the money on the tech startup. But I think if I had done it over again today, I have kids who are now at the verge of actually choosing, I would have said that I could have ended up in tech too, actually, or something closely related to retail tech or logistics tech, just because the pace of change. I love change. I love high pace of change, and I think that in the tech sector, it's so much happening now that it's an exciting time to be young and have to be able to choose a career path. So maybe this time I would have gone into tech and ended up in retail through the tech side, maybe.
But always retail.
The thing I love about retail is that everybody has an opinion about it. Like, and I've worked with, for European listeners, it might not be the easier to understand duty free in Norway or Europris, but XXL. But for Scandinavian listeners, this is like everybody has an opinion about what you're doing. Everybody has an opinion about your formats. I love that. That's why I love the B2C part of it. That. It's so fun to work. If I go to a dinner party, I always meet people who tell me what I should have done. So it's I like that part of with retail, that it creates engagement.
Actually, that's the same with marketing. Everybody knows everything about marketing, but sometimes I feel like it's kind of annoying.
Yeah, and actually with marketing, this marketing is a little bit like logistics, that when I started in retail, the larger than life heroes in the companies, they were the marketing directors. They were like, they could discuss the colors of the ads, they could discuss the messaging, and we could debate for hours about what was the right thing to do. I would say today, as I said, I don't care what you do as long as it works. Tell me what to do. Do an A/B testing on it. It's the consumer who chooses. Look at the data. So 25 years ago, it was about colors and about creative stuff. Now it's a lot about whatever color the cat has, as long as it catches mice, it's okay. And so I think that it has become much more analytical, much more data-driven. Also in marketing, of course, logistics and supply chain has always been a little bit more analytical and data driven. But I think today, the biggest change from 25 years ago is that being a retailer today is all about data and about processes and systems and structure. 25 years ago, you could still have, it was to have having that swagger was kind of an important part of the success. But today, it's much more data-driven.
In our intro call, we already talked about your time management recommendations, because I feel like since our intro call, I won't ever have the right to say I don't have any time again. So I think that might be also interesting for our audience. So now is the time to share your time management skills with us.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I can learn teach people so much about time management. But first of all, I think I've done my fair share of work, I have to say. So I've been working working hard. But yep. But also because it's for me, it's not necessarily just work. I love what I'm doing. So, you know, it's really like I am a retail nerd. So most fun thing I can do is to talk about, learn about new systems and the details of systems and stuff like that. But of course, I also had three kids. So I sort of always said to myself that you try to have prioritize in life. You have to start with the big things first. It's like if you want, someone told me a picture, which is like if you want to fill a really huge vase with sort of flowers, you first put some stones in it, and then you put some smaller stones, and then you put sort of dirt, and then you put the plants in it. Yeah. And I think that you start with the big stones, of course, to fill up this huge vase. And the big stones in your life is your family and closest friends. And then the smaller stones are the work. And then on top of it, you have friends and maybe, you know, doing something that you always wanted to do in your life. So I think a lot of time management is just about prioritizing. That when I was CEO, first time I was in my early 30s, I had small kids. My life was, I think it was very exciting, but many people will say it was a little bit boring because, you know, it was family and job and maybe a few friends every now and then. But I was happy with it, you know, because I knew that this is a phase in your life where family and the work is the most important. I think when you get frustrated, this is if you want to do all other things at the same time. Then, you know, the day only have 24 hours. And if you try to pack too much into it, you just get stressed or you don't sleep enough or you don't work out and take care of yourself. And then that's going to come back to haunt you. So I think just having realistic expectations and say that it's fine to be to just have family and work for some time and maybe a few friends that you keep in touch with. That's fine for some time. And then later you will actually get more time once the kids get bigger and you get more experience in your job. Then it's easier to sort of fill up with things in life. And now I can do much more of things that I would like to do too.
Nice. But yeah, I think it's really nice to hear from you also with your kind of career path that family and friends have such a meaning. So I think, yeah, that sometimes may be rare that you can still prioritize this, but I guess your family will be very happy and you still made a nice career. And also about other priorities or something which is, I think, on the mind of a lot of young people is now you act as an investor. Do you think that there's like some particular startups which should be on all of our watch list actually?
Of course, I think it's sort of that's a difficult question because being an experienced CEO doesn't mean that I know the next Google or the next Facebook or whatever. But I think that I would look for areas where there's a lot of change happening. So I and we talked about some of these things already. That you know that when I 20 years ago when I started in working in retail, there was a lot of there were some innovations actually in replenishment systems. It was a lot of it in automation. It still is, but that was where, like the first big changes came. So that if you had asked me 20 years ago, I would have said Relex, which is a Finnish company that has won a lot of replenishment tenders lately. I think they're a unicorn now. But when I was there, I think I was the customer number 3 or something. They were like a Finnish startup. Nobody knew who they were. Now they're a unicorn. Today, I think it's definitely going to be automation in some way. I was on the board of Oda, this Norwegian e-commerce grocery. So they have, of course, done semi-automation within grocery retail. I think that at some point we are going to have really on-scale automation of online grocery picking. And I think that kind of robotization and automation is just going to continue improving. It is already really, really good today with systems like AutoStore and others, but I think it's just going to be even better in the future. Someone said that robotization is just a physical manifestation of AI. So you could say that, of course, as you see the development in AI, of course, there's also going to be even more development in robotization and automation. I don't have any specific companies in that area that I sort of see now, but I have engaged in a couple of companies that are working more earlier in the phase, so more in the category management, marketing management. So I'm a sort of small owner and an advisory board member of a company called Temalogic. They are doing retail systems. That's where I do the nerding. So that's we develop systems for category managers to in order for them to do their work, structure the category management work. Because replenishment and logistics has already been structured and automated and professionalized. But if you go into 50 retailers and you ask the category department, how do you keep control of your assortment? I think that surprisingly many will say, yeah, well, I have an Excel sheet here where we keep it, maybe a monster Excel sheet or something, or a very simple system solution. So I think there are more and more sort of category and marketing planning systems that are coming. And that's an area that I'm very interested in. Because I also think that if you're going to do hyper-personalization of marketing, then you need to actually also have a system for cataloging the marketing activities and what you're doing in all the different channels and stuff. So a lot of companies, they are not ready for hyper-personalization because they don't have the structured data on what campaigns have you done over the last 5 years. In which channels, which products, what prices, what was the effect, and so forth. They don't have the data because that's in an Excel sheet and that's not so easy to put into these machine learning systems of the future. So I think that that's one area where I sort of where I'm working on. I am a chairman of the board of an IT consultancy. They are actually. It's called Forte Digital. They are in Germany, actually, and also in Denmark and in Norway. So they are basically helping companies establishing digital platforms, which is very important because if you're going to use more and more machine learning and artificial intelligence, you need data to work on. And in order to do that, again, if you ask many retailers, where are your data? They are in different systems and not necessarily old in the right format. So helping companies establishing those digital platforms, I think it's quite exciting, and they're doing very well. So at least it seems like a lot of companies are working on it. The last thing that I was thinking about when is something which is nothing with logistics and nothing with retail. It's something called Oivi. Oivi is a Norwegian Indian company that is scanning people's eyes, and they're doing it with a sort of hardware device that is radically cheaper and better than what you have on the market today. So basically, and we do this in order for to scan. The first application is to scan people who have diabetes, because if you have diabetes, which is increasingly many people have. You're actually developing, you have a 30% chance of developing an eye sickness that can make you blind if you don't do anything. And these, with this radical sort of better and cheaper solution, you can actually deploy these machines or basically in all pharmacies or all doctors across India, for example, or in the US.
That's cool.
And then you can put machine learning and AI on it, and then you can automatically detect the disease. So that's a company that is very exciting because it's good for society, but it's also like a huge business idea because it's I think 15% of the world population has diabetes, and 30% of them are developing this sickness, and not. The majority is actually not checking their eyes regularly, so they can actually develop this sickness that can lead to blindness. So that's a kind of a good thing to do, but also a very, very interesting business opportunity. And it has a global reach.
For sure. So definitely some hot tips. And I think that's also super cool. Proves the point that you're always learning. And I think, yeah, thanks a lot for the conversation. And I would say my main takeaway of today's conversation is that if you really grow, no matter if it's in retail or any other kind of industry, that you also have to consider logistics, actually. And moreover, looking more into the future, that sustainability within this growth also actually plays a major role. So what about you, Pia? What is your main takeaway from today?
I think my main takeaway is that the goal shouldn't be to be the best at once, but to always just be a little bit better. Because I think this doesn't only apply to logistics, but also to real life, or I mean, logistics is real life, but to every other aspect of your life. And yeah, I think that's a really cool and achievable goal.
One thing that we didn't talk about, which if there's people who's in their early careers and you know, want some advice, one of the things that I really learned in my 25 years, which we didn't talk about, which has also nothing to do with logistics, but is this: the most important thing you do is to work with the right people. So choose a career within logistics because it's exciting and it's a critical part of success in many industries. But once when you choose a career path within logistics, if you work with the right people, you learn a lot, you become so much better. Even the best job, if I look back and I say, what did I do right and what did I do wrong? The times I did right was when I chose to work with the right people. And the few times when I did wrong was when I maybe for other reasons didn't work with the right people. So it's really, especially early in your career, it's more important who you work with than what you do or whether the title is very nice or something like that. Because you're building the value of yourself as a talent. And if you work with good people, then you're really, really learning a lot. So that was a final piece of advice.
Really valuable advice, I guess. So also from my side, thanks a lot for the conversation today and for sharing your insights on logistics and retail with us, Paul.
Thank you.
This is it for today's episode of Out of the Box. I hope you enjoyed it and tune in again in 2 weeks.